There will be two readings next week. On Wednesday night in the Terrace Lounge, five students will read. They are Mary Clark, Laurie Craig, Michael Noll, Rhonda Opitz, and Walter Willett. That's 1 week from tonight in the Student Union Terrace Lounge. And on Thursday night, Writers at Work sponsoring a joint reading by Ed Abbey and Clyde Moneyhun. And that will be in this auditorium. That's Thursday the 16th. We would like to put out one more newsletter before the semester is finished, so we've made Friday our deadline to get news. We publish only good news. I hope you can all come to the reception tonight to meet Mr. Gardner, who will be in the usual place in the Terrace Lounge in the Student Union. If you've not been over there, go to the most inaccessible corner of the Union, and that's the Terrace Lounge. It's a great treat to have John Gardner with us. His reading is sponsored by the Drama Department. He's here in conjunction with a very fine presentation of a dramatization of his novel, The Sunlight Dialogues. And the play will be nightly through the 12th with matinees on the weekend. For information, call the Drama Department. Mr. Gardner's currently at State University of New York at Binghamton, New York. He also teaches at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. In addition to his novels, he's written The Life and Times of Chaucer, two collections of short stories, King's Indian and The Art of Living, which has just been published, and copies of that will be available for sale tonight at the reception. He's very well known for his criticism on moral fiction, and you may not be aware that he also writes books for children and opera libretti. His most recent novel is Freddie's Book. I'm very happy to introduce to you John Gardner.
Thank you. I haven't decided for sure what I'm going to read to you tonight, but it'll come to me. But I know that the first thing I'm going to read to you tonight is a thing I wrote for a friend of mine named Peter Bluecloud. Peter Bluecloud runs a magazine which is called Coyote's Journal, and well, he with some friends, and coyotes, no doubt. It's a journal which is devoted to anything anybody wants to say about coyotes. He is, as you might guess from that name, Indian. And coyote is an old Indian mythic figure of cunning and intellect, and sort of represents everything Athena represents in the good old days. And there's another figure of intellect. I'm telling you all this because you need to know it for the story, otherwise the story will be totally meaningless, right? Which it will be in any case. Another figure of intellect is the crow. Crow is associated with the wisdom of the poet, which of course from the point of view of any good microbiologist is stupidity. And this is a story about coyote and crow. The magazine, one can send anthropological articles, articles on Indian affairs if you can somehow coyote slant it, anything, including, you know, zoological studies of coyotes. I think it's wonderful that there's a magazine in the world that's devoted to one animal, you know, instead of, you know, a fiction magazine. I mean, that's a very, you know, mixed up animal. But this, everything, okay. This is called Coyote and the Dead Man. I'm really reading it to you because I'm in Arizona. And I was trying to think, you know, what can one do from Pennsylvania, you know, to impress the Arizonans? And if you know that I have a story about coyote, maybe you won't hate me. This is called Coyote and the Dead Man. I should also mention that when Peter Bluecloud asked me, I maybe just talk to you tonight, but when Peter asked me to write this story, I was very embarrassed because he's a very fine writer. A legender, he calls himself, an Indian writer. They don't like the word fictionist and poet and that kind of stuff. And he writes beautiful coyote stories. So I told him I just can't do that. You know, it's not my culture, and it would be an insult, you know, to you guys for me to write a coyote story. It would be an effrontery. And I said, but maybe if you let me just do a kind of Saturday morning cartoon coyote, you know, it'd be all right. And he allowed us how that was all right. One day, Coyote opened his door to step into the world, and what should be lying there right across the stoop of his door but a dead man? Coyote scowled, then glanced back to see if his children had noticed, but they hadn't. Then he slid his eyes around to see if any of the neighbors were looking, but so far, so good. He stepped over the dead man with delicate feet, then leaned back to pull the door shut, then carefully dragged the dead man into the bushes and sat down to think. He thought, lightning fast, as was his way, about why such things had to happen in the world, why this particular dead man should be laid at his door and not crows, for instance, the smell of him ruining the morning. And then Coyote thought of a plan. He leaned down to the dead man and said, "Listen, brother, we've got to change the world. Are you up to it?" The dead man opened his eyes to look at Coyote with deep disgust. "Dead friend," said Coyote, "let me phrase it another way. What is it that interests such elevated spirits as yours and mine except truth and justice and the dignity of life?" This was not really what was deepest in his heart, but he felt it would be wise to take the high line with the dead, at least in the beginning. Get one of them riled up, there was no telling what it might lead to. The dead man closed his eyes. He was tired. "Let me put it yet another way," said Coyote. The dead man's eyes closed tighter. "Listen, you," said Coyote, and leaned far over to whisper behind his paw into the dead man's ear. "I know you're kind. Get up and follow me, and believe you me, you won't be sorry." The dead man groaned. He thought it would be just the same old thing. But he stirred one finger, then another, and pretty soon, not so steady, a little absent-minded, he was up on his feet. "It better not be far," he said. "Believe me," said Coyote, "it's not far." Coyote set off, whistling under his breath, darting back and forth on the road to have a look at things, whatever other travelers had thrown away or sadly left behind or accidentally dropped, but there was nothing, just junk, and the dead man came slowly behind him. His eyes were closed to slits, and he was too tired and bored to pick up his feet. He just slid them, first one shoe, then the other, on the dirt. His hands hanging down past his pockets never moved at all. It took them so long to get 50 feet that Coyote was secretly in a fury and could hardly remember his plan, but all he did was whistle under his breath a little harder. Coyote led the dead man to the window of the house, and they looked in, and lo and behold, there was a beautiful maiden kissing a chicken on the head. "Wow," said Coyote, putting all his soul into it. "What a beautiful maiden! Look at that hair! Look at that soft, pretty mouth!" The dead man's eyes were falling farther shut, and carefully, so the dead man wouldn't notice what he was doing, Coyote reached up and opened them a little. Then Coyote smiled tenderly, letting his own eyes fall closed a little as if his heart were ravished and he were half in a dream, and he said, "Look at how sweetly she's kissing that chicken." The dead man was fast asleep, so that when Coyote tugged at his arm, he almost tipped over. But Coyote caught him and with difficulty led him around to the front of the house, and finding the door open, led him in where the maiden was. "Tell me, beautiful maiden," Coyote said, as if faint with emotion, "why are you kissing that chicken on the head? Is it really your father that's been transformed by a witch? Or is it perhaps that you're so saddened by life that you're willing to take anything?" "I don't know," said the maiden, blushing a little and becoming even prettier. "She's my pet, that's all. Is there something wrong with that?" Then she saw the dead man and began to scream and bat the air to drive out the smell of him. "No matter," thought Coyote, and helped the dead man back out through the door. It was obvious that dead people cared no more for beautiful maidens than for turnips. Getting rid of the dead man, he was beginning to see, might not be all that easy. They went about 60 or 70 feet and found the part-time residence of a visiting chieftain who'd been all around the world and had all the good and evil spirits at his bidding. They found a ladder against the wall left by some thieves who had tried to sneak into the place a while before but had been chased off by the dogs. When the dogs saw the dead man, they went slinking away with their tails between their legs. Coyote and the dead man climbed the ladder, Coyote pushing the dead man from behind. It was hard, hard going. And looked in at the window. The whole room was filled with gold and jewels and priceless artifacts gathered by the spirits and by the chieftain's own hard work and sound business practices. "Wow," said Coyote, "will you look at all that treasure?" With apparent greed and avarice, he smiled up at the dead man on the ladder just above him, and then instantly Coyote's smile turned to dismay, for the dead man, who was now in a deep sleep, no more interested in treasure than in a bundle of sticks, was tilting backwards, far off balance, and would soon come crashing down on Coyote, and both of them would go banging down the ladder onto the paving stones.
Coyote reached up and pushed the dead man's hind end and got him balanced again. Then, carefully, slowly, back down the ladder went the two of them. Coyote gnashed his teeth. 100 feet later, they came to old mountain lion's house, and Coyote thought, what was there to lose? You might as well try it. So finding the door open, he went into old mountain lion's house with the dead man. As usual, sure enough, old mountain lion was doing the various things he believed one should do to keep fit. He would let out a bolt of lightning from the bottle where he kept them, and would race the bolt to the far wall of his house, running so fast he could no longer be seen, and then he would throw himself against the wall just in time for the lightning bolt to hit him, crash. Sometimes he would take it directly in the chest. Sometimes, with an elegantly casual look, he would tip up an elbow and take it there, or he'd take one on the heel. Occasionally, showing off, he would take a small one in the eyeball, which would briefly turn the eyeball bluish-white, like a sapphire. When he'd outrun lightning bolts and allowed them to hit him for an hour or so, he would sit down, panting hard and wiping his forehead, and then he'd begin on his muscle builders. He would pick things up, set them down again, pick them up again, set them down again, and so on, starting with relatively light things, like the house, and moving to relatively heavy things, like the mountain. "Wow!" cried Coyote, when old mountain lion had the mountain over his head, straining every muscle and trembling with the effort of it, his eyeballs bulging, sweat pouring off him like water from a waterfall. "Look at that physical power and fierce determination!" The dead man said nothing, and when Coyote looked around, he saw that the dead man had allowed himself to sink back onto Mountain Lion's chicken coop, his arms stretched wide, head fallen limply to one side, mouth open, eyes shut. Grimly, whistling under his breath harder than ever, Coyote urged the dead man on down the road. "Come on, come on," he nagged. "Be much farther," mumbled the dead man. They came to where the people were all taking part in a great festival. Coyote couldn't remember which one. Traveling with a dead man, he'd lost all track of time. But whatever the name of the festival might be, they were all eating roasted chicken, and Coyote realized that he was hungry. He stood in line with his straw dish, and the dead man came along behind with his, and after they'd been served pieces of chicken and cups of wet red willow tea, Coyote and the dead man went over to where it was shady and found a place to sit. Coyote ate his chicken. It tasted just wonderful, and he was thinking of sneaking through the line again when he glanced over at the dead man and saw, not to his surprise, that the dead man hadn't taken one single bite, but was sitting with his feet crossed, leaning against the tree and looking dead again, with his eyes closed to slits. "Here, I'll trade you," Coyote said, and gave the dead man his empty dish and took the dead man's full one. As he ate, he racked his brains for something in the world that might interest a dead man, and the more he turned the question over, the more he realized how vexatious it was. Beautiful maidens were no better than turnips to a dead man, and vast treasures were worth no more than bundles of sticks. Power and quickness were so tiresome to a dead man that they could put him to sleep even on the sharp roof of a chicken coop, and not even the rich smell of roasted chicken could entirely bring a dead man to his senses. Coyote had stumbled, he saw, onto a hard, hard question. He was thinking with such concentration he didn't notice at first that, a little to the left of the tree where the dead man was, an old woman in black with grayish black hair had come with some children to sit down on the grass and eat. And the old woman, to keep the children from hitting each other or stealing each other's food, was telling them all a story. It was one of those stupid, complicated stories about Coyote and Crow, the kind of story Coyote hated, a story with no lesson or purpose in the world, not even so much as a sneaky half-virtue to justify its existence, one of those stories that do nothing but pass the time. Coyote banefully slid his eyes at the children and the old woman, but none of them noticed. "Well," said the old woman, smiling and rolling her black, flashing eyes around from child to child. Crow thought long and hard about which of the baskets to open, the basket made of grass, the basket made of sticks, or the basket made of braided hair. Coyote shook his head and stretched the corners of his mouth down. There had never been any such baskets. It was all lies and foolishness. He wished the old woman would go away and let him think about his problem. But the old woman chattered on, her cracking, dry voice distracting him. She said, "Then Crow got to thinking how Coyote was the trickiest spirit that ever got trapped in a skin, but Chicken, on the other hand, who'd given Coyote the baskets, was so witless and blissful, or small-mindedly spiteful, if that mood was on her, it was hard to be sure she had any spirit at all under her skin." The old woman chuckled. Coyote stood up and, narrowing his eyes, lowering his head so that he looked like a hunchback, carried the dirty straw dishes and cups to the trash ravine. Then he returned to get the dead man and continue on their search. The dead man sat with his eyes a little open and one large lead-gray ear tipped slightly in the direction of the old woman. Stranger and stranger, thought Crow, the old woman was saying, and he looked long and hard at the three trap doors, one with a ring handle of stone, one with a ring handle of buffalo horn, one with a ring handle of turquoise framed in silver. Come on, said Coyote to the dead man, and tapped him on the shoulder. Slowly, the dead man raised one finger to his mouth, signaling Coyote to silence. Coyote stared in horror from the dead man to the old woman, who was croaking on and on, her black eyes a glitter, her hands absent-mindedly picking small wildflowers mixed in with the grass around her and dropping them onto the pile of trash she already had, bits of bright cloth, gleaming metal trinkets, gray and white stones, one robin's egg long since hatched. On his delicate feet, rolling his eyes toward heaven in disgust, remembering now that this had been his plan from the beginning, the old woman was obviously Crow in a typically stupid disguise. Coyote sidled off, and when he was sure he was rid of the dead man for good, turned around, grinning, and flew like lightning straight back to his house, ran in, and slammed the door, and leaned his back on it. Thank you. I don't usually like to read anything that I've written that's already been published. That hasn't. But since this book is available only in Tucson, the publication date of The Art of Living, the last collection of stories I've done, is May 1st, but in Tucson it's earlier because here I am. I thought I'd read one of the stories in this collection. I thought I might read any one of the stories, but it comes to me now that this is the one I'm going to read. My excuse for reading this story is that it's the only other thing that I know that could be remotely related to the West. And the only reason for that is there's this song, you know, Old Bill Jones had two daughters and a song. That's a Welsh name, right? And clearly, this is a story about the Welsh, and that's all. It's called Come On Back. And that's all I'm going to read you, just this story. So I'm sorry you can't see the pictures. The pictures are nice. 45 years ago, I wonder if I should tell you anything about this story. I mean, since I'm here, I'll tell you. I always wanted to get in the New Yorker. You know, I really, really wish they'd publish the New Yorker. And they won't, you know. I write faggotized stories, you know. I write stupid stories, I write experimental stories, you know. I try, but they won't work. So I thought maybe a reminiscence, you know. I mean, the New York is famous for its reminiscences, right? A reminiscence is essentially the stupidest, dullest, most boring kind of story in the world. So eventually, you get fooling around with it a little bit, and a plot starts creeping in, you know, when you really didn't mean. I mean, you know the minute a plot comes in, you're dead at the New Yorker. But, you know, you can't help yourself. And then symbolism starts rearing its disgusting head, and that really is bad at the New Yorker. But that's what happened. So it's my New Yorker story. Not, of course, published in the New Yorker. 45 years ago, when Remsen, New York was called Jack, and nearly all the people who lived there were Welsh, my uncle, or rather my maternal great-uncle, E.L. Hughes, ran the feed mill. His name is no longer remembered in the village, and the feed mill is in ruins, set back behind houses and trees so that you have to know it's there to find it. There's a big sprawling agway that already looks ancient, though it can't be more than 15 or 20 years old, on the other side of town. I seldom get up to that area anymore, but I used to visit often when I was a child living with my parents on their farm outside Batavia. My grandfather Hughes, whom I never knew except by the wooden chest of carpenter's tools he left my father and a few small, tattered Welsh hymn books he left my mother, had originally settled in the village of Remsen, or just outside it. And for years, even past the time of my Uncle Ed's death, my parents made pilgrimages back to see old friends, attend the Kamanvagani festivals, visit the white wooden church called Kapalaka, and keep a casual eye on the mill's decline. At the time my grandfather and his brothers came over, Remsen was generally viewed back in Wales as a kind of New Jerusalem, a shining hope, a place of peace and prosperity. There was a story of a Welshman who landed in New York and, looking up bug-eyed at the towering building, said, "If this is New York, what must Remsen be?" In those days, it was a sleepy little hamlet beside a creek. Though the Depression was on in the rest of the country, you saw no signs of it in Remsen. on the tree-lined streets with tall houses set back from them, each with its roses, small vegetable garden, and grape arbor. There were shined-up square cars, mostly Model A Fords, and occasional buggies. My Uncle Ed, one of the richest men in town, had a black and green Buick. Milk was still delivered in squarish glass bottles by an orange horse-drawn cart. Coal for people's furnaces came on a huge horse-drawn wagon, black with white lettering, W.B. Price and Sons, Coal and Lumber. The horses were chestnut-colored Belgians, I remember, so immense and so beautiful they didn't seem real. At the end of almost every driveway back behind the house, there was a two-story garage with chicken wire on the upstairs windows. If you shouted from the driveway, one or two of the chickens would look out at you indignant like old ladies, but however you shouted, even if you threw pebbles, most of them just went about their business. The people were pretty much the same, unexcitable. There weren't many houses, maybe 20 or 30, a couple of churches, a school, Price's lumber yard, and a combination gas station and market. As we entered from the south, my Uncle Ed's huge gray mill reaching up past the trees into the sunlight was the first thing we'd see. The mill was to the left of the narrow dirt road, a three-towered barn-like building set back beyond the lawn and flower garden that rose gradually toward the brown shingled house where Uncle Ed had lived for years with his wife, my great-aunt Kate. I remember her only dimly as an occasional bright presence, soft-spoken and shy, in my Uncle Ed's kitchen, or in his camp, as they called it, on Black River. She wore thick glasses that made her eyes look unpleasantly large. They shared the house, or anyway the basement, with Uncle Ed's younger brother, my great-uncle Charlie, Charlie they called him, who helped out at the mill for room and board and a trifling wage. Across the road from the mill in Uncle Ed's house stood a blacksmith shop, then still in operation, a dark, lively place full of coal smell, iron smell, and horse smell. All day long it rang like a musical instrument with the clanging of iron on iron, just far enough from the house and mill to sound like bells. The creek ran just behind the blacksmith's shop, a bright, noisy rattle. I used to catch tadpoles and minnows there, those deep in places. If my grandmother found out I'd been playing in the creek, I got spanked. The building's gone now and the creek's fallen silent, grown up in weeds. I remember the building is small, made of stone burned black inside, crowded outside with burdocks whose leaves were always wet with the mist from the waterfall that rumbled day and night not far upstream. I was 5 or 6, still at that age when a day lasts for weeks and everything you see or hear or smell seems vividly alive, though later you can get only glimpses to serve as memories, or anyway, so it seems until you start to write. This much comes back at once. The large, grinning figure of my Uncle Ed, Uncle Charlie next to him, timidly smiling, dwarfed beside his brother, and standing not far from them, Aunt Kate with a dish towel and teapot. I get back, too, a little of the sunlit world they inhabited, seemingly without a care, as if forever. On one kitchen wall, they had a large black pendulum clock on which the 4 was written, I. I could never decide whether the thing was a mistake. I was already aware that the Welsh were prone to make curious mistakes. Was something more mysterious, brought down from the ancient, unimaginable time when, according to Uncle Ed, the Welsh lived in caves and trees and couldn't talk yet, but had to get along by singing. In those days, everything was for me more than most children, perhaps, half real, half ethereal. It was not just the stories Uncle Ed liked to tell. In our farmhouse, I slept with my grandmother, and every night before she turned off the bed lamp, she would read me something from the Bible or the Christian Herald. I didn't remember what she read, but I remember seeing pictures of bright-winged angels playing harps and singing, beings, she insisted, were entirely real as trees or hay wagons. She made my world mythic, her own as well. During the day, she would sometimes go out in our front yard with a hoe and kill grass snakes. It made my father, who was a practical man, furious. "Mother," he would ask, "what harm do they do?" "They bite," she would say. Sometimes my mother would try to defend her. Grandma Hughes had lived in Missouri for a time where there were rattlesnakes, and she was too old to change her ways. "Even a darn fool mule can be reasoned with," my father would say. He was a breeder and trainer of plow horses. But he wouldn't pursue the argument. To me, though, steeped in her Bible and Christian Herald stories, nothing seemed more natural than that my grandmother and her righteousness should be out there in the dappled light below the maple trees, her bright blue eyes narrowed, her whole blade poised, every nerve on the lookout for serpents. Did you ever really see an angel? I once asked her. Since there really were snakes, it seemed to me probable that there were angels. Not that I'm aware of, she said. I thought it over. Did my dad? I doubt it, she said, then bit her lips together, trying not to smile. So I knew in my grandmother's authority, to say nothing of Uncle Ed's, that there was more to the world than met the eye. Or rather, knew that there were two worlds, and it came to seem to me that Remsen, like the valley where Jacob saw the ladder, was one of the places where they connected. Perhaps it was Remsen's peculiar clear light, or the sense of peace my whole family seemed to feel there, gathering with relatives and friends to sing hymns in Kapalukka those bright Sunday mornings. Perhaps it was simply the otherworldliness of a village that spoke Welsh. It was true that time had stopped there, or at very least had paused. We had no blacksmith shops in Batavia. Mr. Culver, who shoed my father's horses, came with his equipment in a panel truck. And the mill where my father took his grain, the GLF, was like a factory. Freight cars on one side of it, track on track of them. And inside, wherever you looked through the billowing white dust, big iron machines and men in goggles. My Uncle Ed, when he worked in the old-fashioned mill in Remsen, wore a suit. It was gray with grain dust, and it was a little disheveled, but it was a suit. Uncle Charlie wore striped bib overalls. Uncle Ed's machinery was mostly made of wood and made very little noise, just a low, sweet humming sound with rhythmical thumps. I would sometimes be left overnight with the two old men and Aunt Kate while my parents went off with younger relatives to some sing. There was always a sing on somewhere around Remsen. Every time three Welshmen meet, people said, it's a choir. In those days, it was more or less true. Everywhere my parents drove, they sang, almost always in a minor key and always in harmony. And every time relatives got together, they sang in almost as many parts as there were people. I'd be alarmed when my parents began dressing for a sing, telling me in a falsely sweet voice that I was to stay with my uncles and aunt and be a good boy. My grandmother, if she was there, would insist on going with them. Though she was nearly 80, she had a voice like a bird, she claimed. The Songfest wouldn't be the same without her. Uncle Charlie would shake his head as if disgusted, though everyone said he'd had a wonderful tenor voice when he was younger. In those days, they said he wouldn't have missed a Comandogani or an Eisteddfod, the really big sing where hundreds and hundreds of Welshmen came together for all the tea in China. Uncle Charlie would blush like a girl when they spoke of his singing days. Well, the body gets old, he'd mutter. Pride, my grandmother would snap, sinful pride. She was a woman of temper. She'd been a redhead when she was young, but for all her sternness, she loved Uncle Charlie as she loved nobody else, her husband's youngest brother, just a boy when she first knew him, all his life, the one who'd been of no account. That voice of his was his downfall, she said once to my mother, wiping dishes while my mother washed. It gave him ideas. To me, a child, it was a puzzling statement, but my mother ruefully nodded, apparently understood. I tried to get my grandmother to explain it later when she was sitting at her darning in our bedroom, more my bedroom than hers, she would say, when a certain mood was on her. Another puzzling statement. Grandma, I asked, how come Uncle Charlie's voice gave him ideas? Hush now, she said. That was always her answer to troublesome questions, and I knew how to deal with it. I just waited, watching her darn, making a nuisance of myself. Well, she said at last, then stopped to bite a thread. She looked at the end, twirled it between her fingers to make it pointed, then continued, singing's got its place, but a body can get to thinking when he's singing with a choir that that's how the whole blessed world should be, and then when he comes down out of the clouds, it's a terrible disappointment. I suppose I looked as puzzled as ever, tentatively considering the idea of people sitting up in the clouds, like the angels in her pictures. She leaned toward me and said, Uncle Charlie never found a good woman, that's what's wrong with him. Bills to pay, whippersnappers, that'll bring you down from your la, la, la. I gave up, as puzzled as before and slightly hurt. I knew well enough, she never let me forget, what a burden I was. Not that she didn't kiss me and make a great to-do when I was dressed up for church or had done something nice for her, dust mopping the bedrooms without being told to or helping her find her brass thimble. She was a great mislayer of things. It made my father sigh deeply and shake his head. I was, in general, as good a child as I knew how to be, but it's true, I was sometimes a trouble. I justified her existence, I realize now. Living with my parents, too old and poor to live alone, she didn't have to think herself a nuisance to the world. As my babysitter, she made it possible for my mother to teach school and for my father to work in the fields all day. All the same, I'm sure I ran her ragged, and there were times, especially when my parents had somewhere to go after dark, when I was as much trouble as I dared to be. I hated those nights when my parents left me for a Grange meeting at home or for a sing when we were in Remsen. I lived through them, I knew. I might even enjoy myself after a fashion, but the night would be darker than usual outside the big old Remsen house when my parents and grandmother weren't somewhere within call, upstairs or in the elegant, dimly lit living room. The mill, much as I loved it by day, looked ominous from Uncle Ed's kitchen window after dark. It would seem to have moved closer, blocking out the starlight like an immense black tombstone. I would hear the clock on the kitchen wall solemnly knocking the seconds off. Talk, talk. The silence so deep, I could also hear the clock on the desk in the living room hurrying as if in panic. Tick, 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 tick. The sunflowers at the end of the garden would be gray now, staring back at me like motionless ghosts, and the blacksmith shop across the road a darker blot in the surrounding darkness. Weeds all around it, hushed as if listening to the clatter of the creek, were transformed in my mind to a terrible place, the overgrown hovel of a coombwitch. I would whine, hanging around, clinging to the white porcelain doorknob as my parents dressed. Why can't I come with you, I'd say. My mother's eyes would remain on the mirror, concentrating hard on the eyebrow pencil. Though she was fat, I thought she was amazingly beautiful. Her hair was dark red. You can when you're bigger, my father would say, standing behind my mother, chin lifted, putting on his tie. In the bathroom, my grandmother would be singing, loosening up her voice. She did sound like a bird, I thought grimly, like a chicken. In the end, knowing I had no chance of winning, I would pretend to be seduced by Aunt Kate's molasses cookies and the promise that Uncle Ed would tell me stories. Sulking a little to show them I didn't intend to forget this, I'd walk with my parents as far as the door, keeping an eye on their red, beaming faces and listening, full of disapproval, to their loud, cheerful talk as they took leave of my uncles and aunt and went down the wooden steps between the house and the big, dark mill to greet the relatives who'd come for them in their car. The inside lights of the car would go on as the car doors opened, and in that little square-windowed island of light, I'd see grown-up cousins and children cousins just a little more than my age, squeezing over, climbing onto other cousins' laps. The alley between the mill and the house would fill up like a pool with laughter and shouts of, "Watch your elbows," and sometimes my father's voice, carefully patient, "That's all right, Mother, take your time." Then the doors would close, leaving only the headlights, and the car would chuff, chuff, chuff past the mill, and listing like a carriage, would go around the corner at the end of the garden, then listing again, tail lights like two garnets, would veer out onto the road, briefly lighting up trees. When the tail lights were out of sight, I would turn, trying not to cry, to Uncle Ed, who would lift me and carry me on his shoulder like a feed sack to the kitchen. "So," he would say, "I guess you didn't know I used to work for a bear." "I don't believe it," I would say, though I did, in fact. "Big old black bear named Herman used to live up by Blue Mountain Lake." He often said his stories on Blue Mountain Lake or on nearby Black River where his camp was. He would take us there sometimes, to my grandmother's dismay. An immense log and stone lodge filled with stuffed lynxes, wolves, and owls, Japanese lanterns overhead, and on the rustic tables a whole museum's worth of strange objects Aunt Kate had collected. Little models of birch canoes, carved figures, a stereopticon with pictures of Paris long ago. The lodge was set in among trees, all but inaccessible, a wooden dock below it where Uncle Ed's guideboat was tied during the day. The water in the river, shallow and clear as glass, seemed hardly to move, but when you dropped a leaf on it, it quickly sped away. Fish poked thoughtfully in and out among the shadows of underwater weeds, and when you looked up, you saw a world almost equally strange, pine woods and mountains, large hurrying clouds of the kind I thought angels lived on, huge white mounds full of sunlight. Whenever Uncle Ed began to speak of the Adirondacks, you knew that in a minute he'd be telling of his childhood in Wales, where people lived in cottages on dark green hills with their sheep and collie dogs, and nothing ever changed. All through supper, Uncle Ed would tell me stories, Aunt Kate tisking, moving back and forth between the table and the stove, patting my head sometimes, telling me not to believe a word of it. Uncle Charlie would sit grinning as if sheepishly, sometimes throwing me a wink, sometimes saying a few words in a high-pitched voice, trying to make me think it was the parrot, Bobby Watson, who stood watching and pecking at the lettuce in his cage in the corner. Uncle Charlie was as small-boned as a sparrow and had startling eyes, one brown, one blue. Though he was almost as old as Uncle Ed, he had light brown hair and a brown mustache, a shiny, soft brown with hardly any gray in it. Perhaps it was partly the way he sat, head forward, eyes lowered, his hands on his knees, except when he raised his fork or spoon. He seemed, even with all his wrinkles, just a boy, no bigger than Uncle Ed's right arm. People who didn't know them thought Uncle Charlie was Aunt Kate's brother, not Uncle Ed's. She too was, she liked to say, petite. After supper, while Aunt Kate washed dishes and the two old men went out to the mill to catch up, really to smoke cigars, I would bang on Aunt Kate's piano in the living room. The piano was a good one, a Story and Clark upright. In the Tiffany dimness of the living room, its cold black surfaces shone like mirrors or like Black River at night, and everything I played on it sounded to me like real music. I would lose all track of time, closing my eyes and tipping my head to the piano sound, dark, sustained chords that in my mind made a shadowy place you could move around in, explore like an old-time Indian. When my uncles and aunt came together again after the dishes and cigar smoking, they'd call me back and we'd play dominoes at the kitchen table. After an hour or so, Uncle Charlie would say, grinning, not meeting anyone's eyes, "Well, time to turn in, by gall, ain't it?" And he'd go down to his narrow, yellow, wallpapered room in the basement. I'd sit a little longer with Uncle Ed and Aunt Kate. They must have known how I hated to go upstairs alone in that big, quiet house. But it was Aunt Kate's habit to listen to her records, some of them old, thick Edison records, most of them opera, and so for a while before going up to bed. And it was Uncle Ed's habit to settle down across from her, heavy and comfortable as an old gray cat, draw on his steel-rimmed spectacles, and read. They were both too old to go climbing that narrow back stairway twice. The front hallway stairs were wide and glossy with a runner down the steps. I don't remember anyone's ever using them much except my cousins and me playing Chinese school. Aunt Kate was brittle and climbed steps one at a time. As for Uncle Ed, he was huge for a Welshman with hair as white as snow. When I began to nod, he'd say, looking at me over the spectacle rims, "You run up and put your pajamas on, buddy. We'll be up in a jiffy." As I think back to it, it surprises me that I didn't make a fuss, but I obeyed without protest, knowing I'd be long asleep before they got there. Once in a while, I'd wake up for a minute when they came, and I'd see them in their white flannel nightgowns kneeling beside the bed. Pretending to be asleep, I slept on a cot across the room from them. I'd watch them bow their heads side by side and press their hands together just below their chins, and I'd listen to their whisperings in Welsh. Uncle Ed had three stubbed fingers cut off in a grist mill when he was young. His rounded shoulders were enormous. In my memory, no doubt inaccurate, they went a third the length of the bed. In the mill during the day, Uncle Ed was like a king, lifting heavy feed sacks as if they were nothing, chattering lightly past his dead cigar, mostly in that clicking, lilting gibberish he spoke. But now, for all his size, he was as subdued and meek as Uncle Charlie or Aunt Kate there beside him. The only light in the room was the dim one on the table beside the bed. It made his hair look soft, like a baby's. Aunt Kate's hair was like fine silver wire. One time when we were visiting, Uncle Charlie took what they all called later a tumble. I'm not sure how much of it I actually saw. I was, as I've said, only five or six. A few sharp images have stayed with me all these years, but for the rest, I must trust imagination and family stories. I remember sitting in the office at the mill, that time or some other time, drawing on one of the yellow legal-sized notepads Uncle Ed used for figuring and keeping records, the pot-bellied stove unlit in the corner. It was August, I know because farmers were bringing their wheat in. All around the stove stood pale bluish salt blocks, the slippery blue-white of bone in a butcher shop, and stacked around the salt blocks there were bales of twine and barbed wire, kerosene lanterns, and zinc-coated buckets set one inside the other, the top bucket filled with nails. Outside the window, I could see Aunt Kate's garden aglow at that time of year with roses, zinnias, and sunflowers, vegetables down the middle, at one end a scarecrow in a washed-out ragged coat and straw hat that had once been, no doubt, Uncle Charlie's. There were farmers in the room with me, riched back on their round-backed wooden chairs, talking and joking as they always did while they waited for Uncle Ed to grind their grist and then for Uncle Charlie to load the bags on the two-wheeled feed truck and roll them to the dock, then lift them down a foot or two onto the wagon. No doubt I'd been running back and forth with Uncle Charlie for most of the morning, since that's what I usually did, neither of us talking. Uncle Charlie almost never talked, except when he pretended to be the parrot in the kitchen. I, for my part, trying to be of help, snatching an empty feed sack from his path, though in fact there was plenty of room, trying to push a heavy door open further. But now I was in the office, weary of the game, half listening to the singing of the wooden walls as they resounded to the mill wheels, and drawing rabbits so much like those my father drew, rabbits were all he knew how to draw, that if you'd asked him later, he couldn't have told you for sure which one of us had done them. I heard no shout, no noise of any kind, but suddenly the farmers were up out of their chairs, running in their heavy boots from the office into the mill, and as fast as I could get down out of my chair, I was after them. Where the wooden machinery thudded and sang, sending up white powder, nothing was wrong. Uncle Ed stood blinking as the farmers ran up to him and passed him. Then he pushed the worn, smooth wooden lever that made the rumbling stop, caught me up in his arms, and ran after the farmers. When we came to the sunlight beyond the open door, we found Uncle Charlie climbing up from between the loading dock and one of the farmers' wagons, furiously shouting and wiping dirt from his mouth and mustache. The wagon had been carelessly parked, a 3-foot gap between the dock and the wagon bed. On the wagon where Uncle Charlie had dropped it when he stepped into the gap and fell, a sack lay split open, slowly drizzling grist down through the slats onto the ground. He shouted louder than before, no doubt swearing in Welsh, an amazing sound from a man always so quiet. And with a look half enraged, half guilty, he tried to get up on his feet and save the grain. Then another look came over him, surprise, indignation, and one leg cocked like a corn knife flipped out from under him. Uncle Ed set me down, almost threw me from him, and jumped onto the wagon, holding out his arms as if to pick up Uncle Charlie, then thought better of it, or got confused. He just stood there, bent at the waist, arms thrown forward, like a child playing catch. At the top of the stairs across the way, the back door of the house opened, and my grandmother came out in her knitted black shawl. "Land of Goshen," she cried in a loud, angry voice, "now look what you've done." My father came out behind her, looking baffled and apologetic, as if he hadn't been taking a nap, he could have prevented it. "Now stop that," he said to my grandmother, almost absent-mindedly, and instantly she stopped. Tears ran down the sides of Uncle Charlie's mustache, and he clung to his leg with both hands, not shouting now, clamping his lips together and whimpering. Then Aunt Kate was there with them, nearsightedly bending forward. "I'll call the doctor," she said, turning, and went back into the house. "It's all my fault," one of the farmers said, shaking his head and working his jaw as if in a minute he meant to hit himself. "Here now," Uncle Ed said, "let's get you inside." And carefully fitting his arms under Uncle Charlie, taking pains to support the broken leg, he lifted him like a child or a newborn calf and carried him up onto the loading platform, over to the steps at the far end, then down and across the way and up the wooden stairs toward the kitchen. "Mercy," my grandmother said, unable to control herself, her eyes as bright as when she went out with a hoe to kill snakes. My mother took her arm and patted it. I was, of course, not aware at the time that they all felt as guilty as I did. Even my grandmother, I realize now, must have felt guilty, shouting at us all as if she secretly believed she should have taken better care of us. But whatever they were feeling, they soon got over it once Uncle Charlie was inside on the couch in the living room. I myself took longer. It was a matter of fact to me that if I'd been doing my job, running along with Uncle Charlie and his feed truck, keeping his way clear and watching out for trouble, he'd never have fallen down and broken his leg. The doctor, when he came, was professionally grave. Aunt Kate wrung her hands in her apron. I offered, bursting into tears as I did so, to pay Uncle Charlie's doctor bills. Uncle Ed just looked at me, lips puckered in surprise. None of the others seemed to have noticed what I'd said. "I really will," I bawled, clinging to his leg. "Here now," Uncle Ed said. "Katie, get this boy a cookie, and then go on now. Away with you both." I went with her, looking over my shoulder at Uncle Charlie, gray-faced on the couch, the doctor in his black suit bending down beside him. They were all smiling now, even Uncle Charlie, all of them describing what had happened as a tumble, or all except my grandmother, who always took, according to my father, the darkest possible view of things.
My mother and father had a fight that night because they thought I was asleep. My father said my grandmother was an angel of death. His anger may have made him unusually poetic, though now that I think of it, he said the phrase as if he'd used it against her many times. If you hate her so, my mother said, why don't you just send her the old folks home? Thus my mother won, as she always did. When it was clear to them both that she'd won, she said, oh, Bill, she's just worried. You know that. She's like a child. I lay in the darkness with my eyes open, trying to make sense of the queer idea. It wasn't until the following summer that my family visited Remsen again. Letters passed back and forth two or three a week in the meantime, Aunt Kate telling us of, among other things, Uncle Charlie's gradual recovery, not as quick as it should be, she let us know. My mother sending back our family's encouragement and sometimes inspirational poems from my grandmother's magazines. When we finally went to visit, it was partly because of Kaman Vagani, a singing festival, was to be held nearby in Utica. At Uncle Ed's, I learned to my surprise and dismay, since I disliked change, hated to see any slightest hint that the universe might not be orderly to the core, as smooth in its operations as an immense old mill, that my uncles and aunt, though they'd never before shown much interest in such things, were planning to go to the festival with my parents and grandmother. I learned it by eavesdropping. When I was supposed to be asleep, as Uncle Charlie was, down in his basement room, snoring with his mouth open, I'd sneaked down early and seen him there, lying with one arm hanging over the bedside. I crept without a sound down the front hallway stairs and settled near the bottom to listen to the voices in the living room just to my left. Aunt Kate was saying, speaking more softly than usual, he could do with the lift. I learned it by eavesdropping. When I was supposed to be asleep, as Uncle Charlie was, down in his basement room, snoring with his mouth open, I'd sneaked down early and seen him there, lying with one arm hanging over the bedside. I crept without a sound down the front hallway stairs and settled near the bottom to listen to the voices in the living room just to my left. Aunt Kate was saying, speaking more softly than usual, he could do with the lift. He's still down, isn't he? My mother said. Oh, Charlie be fine, Uncle Ed said, hearty as ever, and gave a laugh. I listened uneasy for what my grandmother would say. When she said nothing, I let myself believe she'd fallen asleep over her sewing. He keeps in too much, that's all, Aunt Kate said, as if shyly, embarrassed that Uncle Ed hadn't agreed with her. So anyway, we'll all go, my father said, settling things. Take Buddy, too. He's never been to Kaman Vagani yet. How do you tell me when? Heavens to Betsy, my grandmother burst out. You'd let that poor whippersnapper stay out till midnight with a bunch of wild, drunken lunatics howling their miserable heads off? A shiver went up my back. I was much too little-minded a child to fit a description with any kind of singing I'd ever heard of, much less any I'd been in on. I remembered stories my Uncle Ed had told me of how the Welsh were all witches in olden times, how they used to fly around like birds at night and make magic circles among trees and stones. The following day was so filled with anxious anticipation, I could hardly breathe. Out in the mill, I kept close to Uncle Charlie, trying to guess every move he was about to make and help him with it. He seemed small all over since the accident. Though he wore arm elastics, his cuffs hung low, as did the crotch of his overalls. His hands trembled, and he no longer bothered to put his teeth in. In the past, he'd pretended to appreciate my help. Now, as I gradually made out, it annoyed him. I'll get that, he'd say, kicking a twine barrel from the aisle as I reached for it. Or as I ran to push a heavy door open further, he'd say, leave it be, boy, it's open far enough. Excuse me. In the end, I did nothing for him. Simply stayed with him because I was ashamed to leave him and go look for Uncle Ed. He no longer did the kinds of work he'd done before. The 100-pound sacks were too heavy for him. He wasn't much heavier than the sacks himself. And when he pushed the feed truck after Uncle Ed had loaded it, both Uncle Ed and I would watch him in distress, afraid it would tilt too far back, off balance, and fall on him. Mostly, Uncle Ed had taken over the pushing of the feed truck. Go ahead, then, Uncle Charlie said crossly. It's your mill. To keep busy, Uncle Charlie set rat traps, wound wire around old ladder rungs, swiped down cobwebs, swept the floors. He still joked with farmers as he'd always done, but it seemed to me the lightness was gone from his voice, and his eyes had a mean look as if he didn't really think the jokes were funny or the farmers his friends. Sometimes in the office when the farmers were alone with Uncle Ed and me, one of the farmers would say something like, Charlie's getting better every day, looks like, and I would know by their smiles that none of them believed it. I would stand by the heavy old oak desk, full of pigeonholes and secret compartments. Uncle Charlie had once shown me how to work them all, trying to guess what Uncle Ed might need. His pocket-sized notebook, one of his yellow pads, or one of the big white pencils that said E.L. Hughes in red. But I could never guess which object he'd want next, so I could serve no useful purpose except if he happened to look over and say, "Buddy, hand me that calendar there." Then I'd leap. Out in the middle, Uncle Charlie moved slowly back and forth with a push broom, needlessly sweeping white dust from the aisles, or hammered nails into loosened bin boards, or mended burlap sacks not yet bad enough to leak. Now and then he'd poke his head in, the button collar much too light, much too large for his neck. He would ask Uncle Ed if he'd gotten to Bill Williams' oats yet. "I'll get to it, Charlie," Uncle Ed would say, waving his cigar. Uncle Charlie would frown, shaking his head, then disappear, going about his business. Sometime after lunch, I found Uncle Charlie sitting on the floor beside one of the bins, nailing a round piece of tin, the top of a coffee can, over a hole where bits of grain leaked out. I stood a while watching him. His hand, when he reached his mouth for a nail, shook badly. He pretended not to notice me. After a while, I went over and hunkered down beside him, thinking I might hand him nails from the zinc-coated bucket beside his knee, though at the moment his mouth was as full as a pincushion. When he said nothing, I asked, "What's a kamangagani, Uncle Charlie?" "Welsh word," he brought out through the nails and carefully finished driving the nail between his fingers through the tin. Then he glanced at me guiltily, took the nails from his mouth and laid them on the floor between us. "Means come on back," he said. Then suddenly, his heart not in it, grinned. "Come on back to Wales, that is. That's what all the Welshmen want, or so they think." He tipped his head back as if he were listening. The ray of the sunlight came slanting through the mill, great generous shafts full of floating white specks all whirling and swirling in patterns too complex for the eye to comprehend. It was like being in a church, even better than church. I thought of the trees where Uncle Ed had told me the Welshmen used to worship their peculiar bug-eyed gods. "River gods, tree gods, pig gods, Lord knows what," he'd said. My grandmother wouldn't speak of it. "Your Uncle Ed," she said, "has peculiar ideas." Abruptly, Uncle Charlie dropped his head back down, snatched up a nail, cocked it between two fingers over the tin, and started hammering. "Damn fools," he said, then glanced at me and frowned, then winked. "Tell me something else in Welsh," I said. He thought about it, placing another nail. At last he said, squinting, "You know what buddy means?" Before I could answer, he said, "Means the poet. They used to set great store by poets back in Wales. Only second to kings, maybe not even second. Same thing, kings and poets, different kinds of liars." He looked solemn, his face ash gray under the age spots. I studied him, perturbed, no more perturbed than he was, I realized now, but at six I knew nothing of the confusion of adults. All I knew was that his eyes were screwed up tight, one brown, one blue, and his mustache half covered the black hole of his mouth like a sharp gabled roof of old straw. I asked, "Are we all going to the kamangagani?" His eyes slipped off axis, then abruptly he reached for another nail. "Of course we are," he said. He lined up the nail and with two angry raps drove it home. "Don't worry," he said, "it don't hurt much." I remembered only the inside of the building where the songfest was held. It must have been a church, very large, with wooden walls, as yellow-gray as the walls of a new barn. It was brightly lighted, the walls and overhead beams high above us all glowing as if waxed. Everyone my parents had ever known was there, it looked like. The people milled about for what seemed to me hours, shouting and talking, pressing tightly together, my father moving behind my mother from group to group, carrying me on his shoulders. My grandmother wearing a light black coat and helping herself along on two brown canes. It was only that winter that she'd begun to need them. Went from one old white-haired Welshwoman to another, talking and nodding and laughing till she cried, sometimes pointing a bony, crooked finger across the room and gleefully shouting out a name, though no one could possibly have heard her in all that uproar. Then somehow we got to seats, all of us together, me wedged in between my father and Uncle Charlie. A man got up in the front of the room, he looked like a congressman or a well-to-do minister, and said something. Everyone laughed. He said something more, they laughed some more, and then from somewhere booming around us came organ music. Uncle Charlie was jerking at my elbow, making me look down. He held a small Bible-like book with writing in it. No music, as in the hymn books in our church at home. I hadn't yet seen the ones my grandfather left my mother. Just writing and not a word anywhere that I could read. "You know your do-re-mi?" he asked. looking at me sternly, his face very bright. I shook my head, noticing only now that above the hymn words, all in Welsh, there were little words, do, re, mi, and so on, as meaningless to me at the time as all the others. Uncle Charlie looked up at my father as if in alarm, then grinned, looking back at me. Never mind, he said, you sing what I sing. On every side of us, people were standing up now, a few of them beginning to tap their feet, just barely moving the toes of their lumpy shoes. My father and Uncle Charlie helped me stand up in my chair. Suddenly, like a shock of thunder that made the whole room shake, they began to sing. Most of them seemed to have no need of the hymn books and couldn't have used them anyway, singing as they did with their heads lifted, mouths wide as fish mouths, proclaiming whatever it was they proclaimed, not so much to the front of the hall as to the gleaming roof. They sang as Welsh choruses always do, in numerous parts, each as clearly defined as cold individual currents in a wide, bright river. There were no weak voices, though some, like Uncle Charlie's, were reedy and harsh. Not that it mattered. The river of sound could use it all. They sang as if the music were singing itself through them, sang out boldly, no uncertainties or hesitations. And I, as if by magic, sang with them, as sure of myself every note of the way as the wisest and heartiest in the room. Though I was astonished by my powers, I know, thinking back, that it was not as miraculous as I imagined. Borne along by those powerful voices, the music's ancient structure, only a very good musician could have sung off key. And yet it did seem miraculous. It seemed our bones and blood that sang, all heaven and earth singing harmony lines, and when the music broke off on the final chord, the echo that rang on the walls around us was like a roaring amen. Hymn after hymn we sang, old people, children, people my parents' age, ancient tunes invented before the major mode was thought of, tunes like hugely breathing creatures. We were outside ourselves, caught up in a whirl, as the Welsh say. It really did seem to me once or twice that I looked down on all the congregation from the beams above our heads. My father's hand was closed hard on mine. Uncle Charlie held my other hand, squeezing it just as tightly. Tears streamed from his brown eye and blue eye, washing his cheeks, dripping from his mustache, making his whole face shine. Afterward, when we were leaving, I saw that Aunt Kate, my mother, had been crying too, even my grandmother, though not my father or Uncle Ed. On the steps outside, lighting his cigar, Uncle Ed said, "Good sing." My father nodded and hitched up his pants and turned to look back at the door as if sorry to leave. "Good turnout." Uncle Charlie, with his hands in his pockets, staring at the ground, said nothing. The following night, Uncle Charlie didn't come in for supper, but they called and called. I watched through the kitchen window as Uncle Ed and my father, gray as ghosts in the moonlit garden, shouted toward the trees across the road, the glittering creek, the blacksmith shop, then turned and moved heavily as if gravity had changed and the air had grown thick toward the mill. Later, Uncle Ed, in the wooden armchair in the kitchen, holding his cigar on the hand that had three fingers missing, stared into space and said, "Poor Charlie, I wonder what's got into him." Aunt Kate stood over by the sink with her head bowed, thinking, folding the dish towel, then unfolding it, then folding it again. "I guess we better phone the police," she said at last. "No, don't do that," Uncle Ed said suddenly, as if she'd startled him out of a daydream. He leaned his forearms on the arms of the chair and hefted himself up out of it. "Haul out to the office and phone around among the neighbors a bit," he said, and at once went to the door. "Why not phone from here?" Aunt Kate said, or began to say, then glanced at me and stopped. "Here, let me give you a hand," my father said. The two of them went out, bent forward like shy boys, and closed the door quietly behind them. "I'll give Buddy his supper," my mother said. "I suppose it won't hurt for the rest of us to wait." "That's fine," Aunt Kate said, still folding and unfolding the dish towel. "We should never have taken him to the Songfest," my grandmother said. "I told you it wouldn't be good for him." My mother, herding me over to my chair, said, "Mother, you never said any such thing." "Well, I meant to," my grandmother said, and firmly clamped her mouth shut. Toward morning they found him, I learned much later, right across the road in the creek behind the blacksmith shop. I still occasionally dream of it, though of course I never saw it. Uncle Charlie lying face up below the moonlit, glass-clear surface, staring emotionless at the perfectly quiet stars. Aunt Kate, it turned out, had known all along that he'd gone off to take his own life, though she'd refused to believe it and had therefore told no one. She'd found his clothes that afternoon just a little after sunset, neatly folded and stacked on the chair beside his bed in the room where they let him live downstairs. He'd left them as a message, my grandmother said. For what they were worth, the world could have them back. Now that's enough of that, my father said sharply. Aunt Kate had told herself one foolish lie after another as she explained to us, her hands over her eyes, her glasses on the table in front of her. Perhaps he'd found a lady friend, she'd said to herself, and had gone out and bought himself new clothes, even new socks and shoes. The following night, when everyone knew Uncle Charlie was dead, though no one was admitting it was suicide, they never did admit that, Uncle Ed's living room was filled with people. All the chairs were occupied. Even the arms of them, where boys or young women sat, most of them cousins. And there were people on the chairs my father had brought in from the dining room and kitchen, too. The people were all talking in low voices and sniffling, their eyes wet and red. I sat on one of my father's legs, watching. They talked of the singer Uncle Charlie had been. The festivals would never have been the same without him. They spoke of what a shame it was that he'd never had a wife and children. It would have made all the difference. Then for a while, since sad talk made them ill at ease, they talked about other things, crops and the weather, marriages, politics. Sometimes they talked now in groups of three or four, sometimes all as one group. Aunt Kate served tea. Some of the men had whiskey with them, which Aunt Kate didn't approve of, but she looked at the carpet and said nothing. The clock on the mahogany desk ticked on and on, but neither in the darkness outside nor in the dimly lit living room was anything changing. People stirred a little now and then, shifting position, moving just an arm or foot, sometimes blowing their noses, but no one got up yet, no one left for home. Slowly, the whole conversation died out like the embers in a fireplace, and as the stillness deepened, settling in like winter, an old magic spell, it began to seem that the silence was unbreakable, our final say. Then an old fireman named Cy Thomas, sitting in the corner with his hands folded, twine around his pants cuff, cleared his throat, pushed his chin out, face reddening, eyes evasive, and began to sing. Tentatively, then more boldly, others joined in with him. Aunt Kate, with an expression half timid, half cunning, went to the piano and after a minute sat down, took off her glasses, and began to play. They were singing in parts now, their heads slightly lifted. On the carpet, one after another, as if coming to life, the shoes began to move. Thank you.